Welcome to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast with your host Nicole Rose from the Solidarity Apothecary. This is your place for all things plants and liberation. Let's get started. Hello, welcome back to the Frontline Herbalism Podcast. Guess where I am? I'm in the fucking car park. I'm sorry for not publishing an episode. It's all been a bit like, a bit all over the place, my life recently. Just boring life update, but the week before last, I was feeling like quite unwell, but I was basically trying to preserve my voice because then I was invited to speak at a conference in Malta called Medicine in the Mediterranean, organized by the College of Offshore and Remote Medicine. And they wanted a talk about herbal medicine. So I got to talk about the clinic in Calais, the work in Ukraine, like various things. And it was like an amazing opportunity. And I had terrible like imposter syndrome because it was like very, you know, kind of like lots of doctors and paramedics and like quite biomedical. But I just, you know, did the best with the herbal medicine. I presented a bunch of, you know, like a strong evidence base and like various research papers and stuff around certain plants, as well as just saying, you know, like all the practical things we do in the field. And it was like really fucking well received. Like people were, you know, super lovely to me afterwards, asking loads of questions during the thing. And I was like super grateful basically to be invited and to have that opportunity to talk. But unfortunately, I just was really poorly. I just had, a bad, you know, I was testing for COVID and stuff, but it was obviously some other viral infection. And it just meant the week was a real struggle. And my mum and stepdad came along to help look after the little one. And that was, I was really grateful for that. But I didn't get that many kind of like solid baby breaks. And I haven't been abroad for 3 years or so, like since I did a tour in Italy before I got pregnant. And I'm not like the best traveler at the best of times, but with a toddler, it's like really, really hard. And I haven't had the sort of like money or like nervous system bandwidth to really push out of my comfort zone since I've had the baby for various like life reasons. And I think I was a bit validated going away because I was like, this is why I haven't been doing this. You know, you see all these like Instagram parents that are like, oh, don't let having a baby stop you from doing what you want to do, like you can travel the world. And I'm like, really? Like, how is that kid's nervous system coping with all this like change all the time? But it's probably my stuff because I was dragged around a lot as a kid. And it also just, you know, it's fucking rained all week. I didn't have the right clothing and blah blah blah. But I was, you know, super grateful for that chance. So and then when I got back, I was recovering and doing okay, and then just all of a sudden just smashed, like with a real kind of like post-viral tiredness. Like after Lee fell asleep, I would be falling asleep at 6 o'clock, and normally I do my client calls in the morning and other bits of work when Lee's at nursery, and then in the evening I get like 2-3 hours depending on my energy levels to do like other admin kind of like lower demanding tasks. And I just couldn't do it. I just needed to sleep. So I got really behind on stuff and I got really stressed. And anyway, this is a very long, boring introduction, but I am back. So that's nice. I'm feeling a lot better. And had some extra childcare this weekend, and it was my birthday weekend, so that was nice. Didn't actually do anything other than work in a cafe, but that was like so nice for me after not having any baby breaks. So and had some Chinese takeaway and stuff with a friend and my family. So anyway, I wanted to share something that a friend and I recorded months ago. I'll put the proper blurb in the description, but basically my friend Kez, who is hopefully listening, is an absolute babe. She's been on the show before talking about queer ecology. She's like the fucking most epic of all the plant nerds. She's written loads of amazing books where, you know, the protagonist is like a trans femme, and there's all this like amazing like ecology and sort of social struggle stuff in there. And she's just like a ride or die to me, and I love her so much. And she invited me to talk at an event she was doing, and I could talk online, and she did like a super comprehensive training with different people about ecology. And then we had a kind of like a question and answer session where we were asking each other different questions about, yeah, applying ecology to organizing in terms of like different concepts and what they look like. So this episode shares that recording, and we go into stuff like the difference between kind of like working on your own versus working in collectives, like kind of working class, femme, like compulsive, caretaking, hyper-responsibility patterns. Yeah, just all the things. I think you'll find it super interesting. Let me know what you think, and I'll put her website in the show notes. So please check out all the amazing shit she's doing, order her books, support her work, invite her, pay her to come and speak and do things with you, because yeah, she's just a fucking amazing human and yeah, epic body of knowledge. So yeah, and I will be back soon because the Herbalism PTSD and Traumatic Stress is looming, the course launch. So I need to get my shit together. I've been so overwhelmed with clinical work, which I fucking love, but seeing a lot of new clients, seeing people with the Black Flag Herbal Clinic, and it's just been amazing, like getting my, you know, my teeth into it and getting really stuck in. But I'm starting to slightly neglect other bits of the Solidarity Apothecary. So yeah. So anyway, thank you for listening. I hope the episode is interesting, and I will be back soon. And yeah, don't forget, we're still in the new year phase, in my opinion. I know it's February, but check out the Herbal Path Planner as well. All right. Okay. Take care. Thanks.
Nicole, say hi.
Hello. I'll let Kez introduce our session. Is that all right, Kez?
And then sure, no worries.
But thanks for having me, and thanks so much for the invitation. And the reason I couldn't do longer is because I'm looking after a one-year-old. But I was like, yeah, do it with Kez, because I knew she would smash it, and you have. So anyway, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time introducing myself, not only because I hate it, but I already did it with a lot of the people in the room. I have slides. I'm not going to go there. I think, given that we don't have much time and time with Nicole is so precious, I think we should skip that and get into the good part, which is Nicole telling us about herself. But just briefly, I'm having a really, really nice day. It feels like a really special kind of unique morning. I had such weird dreams. I always do like before an event, and I just feel like we've been having such stimulating conversations, and I feel like I'm also living in double speed because I somehow had prepared material until 6 p.m. Now we're finishing at 3:30 p.m. I've basically prepared a whole year of workshop, and the poor students who were with me this morning are getting a lot of information very fast. So that's how I'm feeling. I have been giving workshops and community organizing since I was 11. I'm an ecologist, both in terms of practice and in terms of having a natural degree in ecology, but also spending a lot of time with non-humans and experiencing their interactions with the living environment. I've been interested in queer ecology for a long time, and that's often what I've been workshopping on recently. So, for example, I'm giving tours at the Natural History Museum, and also outside tours, and just finding these kind of interactions between nature connection and environmental defense, and queer struggles and trans liberation and disability justice, and all these things that are obviously very, very interconnected, but are so often kind of separate or perceived to be separate. And as I'm kind of in the middle of some of those things, it's interesting for me to explore those edges, those overlaps. I've been working on a big nonfiction book, which is partly what this morning's been based on everything from like non-human sex and sexuality through to overlapping grassroots struggles to using to learning from ecosystems and in our designs and our community organizing. So big book all over the place, a bit like my brain. And me and Nicole have collaborated on a few things. So at one point we were going to run a permaculture course together. It didn't happen, but it has to happen one day. I was being reminded of that with some of this kind of like design stuff that I was doing this morning. I was like, oh yeah. I got to edit Nicole's book, which I mentioned to the group this morning, which was such a joy. Like, this was like my last winter, the winter before last winter. And Nicole was like, here's a manuscript, do it. And I'd like, until then I'd edited like small articles or like small pieces or something. And this was the State Violence and Herbalism book, which is like a brick, like you can smash a window with that thing. So I was like, wow, Nicole, okay, that's a lot. And it was so good and I really enjoyed it. And maybe we can talk about it a bit. But yeah, so we did that. The like raising funds and doing like trans prisoner solidarity stuff and the queer animal and plant zines, which are partial fundraisers for the apothecary. And we're always just kind of like doing things back and forth and like just throwing all the working class femme love at each other, which is what the world is built out of. Nicole, over to you.
Aw, and we're also like good friends. Like, Kez has looked after me when I've been really, really poorly before. I was thinking about us going to that massive swimming pool the other day. That came across my memory.
Oh, so good.
So good. But yeah, if anyone wants to smash a window with my book, that would make me very happy. Like, if it was a tactical smashing. Anyway, so I'm just going to talk briefly a little bit about the Solidarity Apothecary. So yeah, it's a project I started, like, I can't remember now, like several years ago. And I was just like informally making medicines for people, who were experiencing repression, like for different things kind of in the UK and Europe. And, yeah, I could sort of see the impact of state repression on people's health and their nervous systems. And yeah, no one was really talking about it because it was like, our movements can be quite sort of macho. Like, I've organized an anarchist movement a long time and it's like, God forbid you talk about your feelings. So I started trying to focus on that kind of like care for people in that way. And I was like really passionate about herbalism and like trying to politicize it. And then, yeah, it's just sort of grown from there really. So I have a book called The Prisoner's Herbal, which is based on my experience in prison. I got a 3.5-year sentence when I was 21 for like an animal liberation campaign. And when I was in prison, I worked in the prison gardens and I got to know the plants that were taught to me by other kind of femmes and working class, like traveler women and older women. And they, yeah, taught me about herbs. And then I did some distance learning courses and I just sort of was a very passionate DIY herbalist for about 10 years before I decided to do some clinical training. Ah, look, she's got them there. But now the book goes to people in prison like worldwide. And there's like several translated editions. And yeah, I'm very lucky to get lots of letters from people in prison who have like, yeah, just developed this whole new relationship with plants to help kind of keep them going on their sentences. And so then I also support people experiencing state violence, like kind of one-to-one. I've stopped doing that since I got pregnant, but I'd have a lot of like calls with prisoner family members or people experiencing repression and put together like herbal recommendations for them and kind of prescriptions. And we would like work together to like support their health. And then the main thing I was doing before I had a baby was working in Calais, in northern France, which is like a border hotspot between France and the UK, where lots of people are trying to cross the British Channel because there's like no safe routes for people to apply for asylum from France for the UK. So people end up risking their lives crossing in small boats or trying to cross on trucks. And I work with a project called the Mobile Herbal Clinic Calais, and we would go with a team of 4 people, including a doctor, and work in the camps, sort of seeing people, taking people to hospital, trying to advocate for them, and also dispensing herbal medicine for like acute needs like coughs and colds, wound care, lots of first aid stuff. Trying to think what else I do. Yeah, I mentioned, Laura mentioned the podcast. So I have a podcast called the Frontline Herbalism Podcast. And I also do like herbal care packages. So groups submit a request and I send them little care packages of blends for their nervous system or their immune system and like an amazing lavender oil, which is like infused with olive oil from the West Bank in Palestine. And yeah, those go out to groups like all around the world. And then, yeah, I'm just like constantly trying to like fundraise to cover that stuff and have a few online courses in sort of herbalism and trauma that fund most of the work that I do, as well as things like this. So yeah, the kind of like income received from this will go towards things like posting things like care packages. I basically like partly fund the Royal Mail in the UK by posting stuff so much. So anyway, but yeah, and then just on the side, like I do a lot of prisoner support stuff. I've got some close friends still in prison and work with a couple of other like anarchist collectives supporting people in prison as my sort of main organizing. Is that okay as an introduction, Kaz? Yeah? Okay. Cool.
Yes, amazing. I feel like you could say that at like a reasonable speed and put in all the details and just talk for like 10 hours about all the things you do before breakfast. Yeah, shall we get into a conversation? I'm really curious. We did, we talked about a few like possible subjects or overlaps or questions we want to like get into. I think the first one I want to ask you about is functional redundancy, because we were just talking about it this morning. And do you know the term, Nicole? Have you heard it before? So two examples kind of illustrate it. There's the spider web, which has a lot of functional redundancy. So spiders build their webs that if you break one thread, other threads are there as redundants that can kind of maintain the function of the spider web to catch bugs. So it's not that it's all like centralized on one thing that falls apart. It's like it has backups. So it's the idea of like having a backup, a plan B. And at the other end of the spectrum would be like a keystone species, where you have like a kelp forest, for example, or even some beaver habitats. And if the sea otters are gone, then basically they were a keystone species. They had like an excessive effect on the other species around them. And without them, all of their interdependent species kind of fall apart and there can be an ecosystem collapse. So in that case, there's not much redundancy. And the sea otters are like, without the sea otters, there's no kelp forest and everything kind of falls apart. So those are kind of two extremes of like how it makes a system more resilient or less resilient. And I was thinking of you when I was talking about the sea otters, because I often think of your role as being a bit of a keystone species role. Don't know if you've ever thought about it this way, but in that I know that in some of your projects, and certainly not all of them, we could also talk about it in terms of centralization or decentralization in our organizing terminology. I know in some projects, when you're sick or you lose capacity or you're away or something, sometimes things, there isn't backups. And sometimes there is. And it, like, I think there's, I guess my question is like, in what cases is it possible and does it work that other people will kind of show up when you lose capacity, for example? Like during pregnancy is a good, probably a good example of that. And when is it just impossible and it's just like it's a Nicole task and only Nicole can do it? I'm just wondering about how that tension is for you.
Oh, do people want like radical honesty or like behind the scenes?
I do. I can't speak for all people.
I think like it's sort of inseparable, that answer, from all the millions of other chats we've had about class and gender. So I think maybe people can resonate, but like as a sort of young carer with a mum with like very serious depression, I learned to be like extremely hyper responsible, where I'm like gauging everyone's needs all the time and just like used to being hyper independent and not asking for help, because if you ask for help, your needs aren't met. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think, and that's obviously like massively gendered, and I've, you know, I've really learned that having a baby as well, of just like, yeah, there's no kind of much help like or infrastructure like in a societal way for femmes who have like vast amounts of responsibility and caring labor. But I do think that that hyper independence creates like this capstone species thing of like, you're so fucking on it and you're reliable and you'll get stuff done because like you don't have any psychological option to like not do something because that will trigger collapse. Does that make sense? So I think it's kind of like what's a choice and what's not a choice of being hyper responsible. But I think the lesson, if the answer is like collective care and stronger collectives, then part of the unlearning for us sort of like working class femmes with like a lot of caring experience is like, how the fuck do we unlearn that and start to trust other people to kind of become more resilient, right? So like the Solidarity Apothecary for me is like this really blissful solo project, which I love doing on my own because it means I don't have to interact with loads of people, which can be quite like relational, like can be triggering and difficult in its own way, even though I'm part of a big ecology of different projects and I do collaborate with people all over the world. But I think other collectives, they are like more sort of foundationally collective, if that makes sense. So me getting pregnant doesn't kind of harm them. Like, you know, it still makes an impact, but yeah, it's just kind of more straightforward. But I think, yeah, it's a challenge of like, yeah, how do the sort of like femmes learn to trust other people? And I think that's why me and Kez work so well together, because you're so reliable and consistent. And you shouldn't have that pressure on you, because I shouldn't have that pressure on me, but we just have that pressure, right? So it's like, I love collaborating with you because you'll communicate really well. You'll communicate your needs. You'll be like really emotional and attentive. You know, oh, my partner's going to hospital today. Oh, are you sure you're comfortable with blah, blah, blah? Whereas like working with other people, they won't have that level of like emotional literacy. So I think it's a mix of trauma forces you to be a capstone, reliable person. But part of liberation is like unlearning your own stuff, right? And that's what we talk about in the PTSD courses, you know, the different nervous system states and the common trauma dynamics and patterns and how they influence things. And I know in collectives, I have to learn to be better at surrendering responsibility and delegating more and receiving support, God forbid. So yeah. Does that make sense as an answer?
It does. It really does. Yeah.
What are your experiences with that?
Yeah, no, very similar. And as you say, it's something we've, like, there's almost no way that we wouldn't talk about it, because I think we have, yeah, like quite resonant experiences there. I think I've often been a keystone species as well, that like, it's, yeah, indeed, it's like survival skills, and it's like a dynamic that everyone kind of falls into. It's not even something necessarily good or bad, it just kind of is. And then sometimes it can be, you can kind of see the danger of it and be like, okay, so like, let's find some way to decentralize. And I think that has often been a goal for me. And I think I can go one way or the other. Sometimes I'm like, actually, it's going to be so much work to like, it's not just trust people, but also like, have people do the thing. I can trust them, but if they don't do it, then I'm still screwed and the project didn't happen. So like, I don't want to call it empowering because it sounds so condescending, but this kind of like skill sharing, or like getting someone to the point where they're being reliable, they're doing what I needed them to do so that the thing happens. Like, that's not just trust, it needs to actually happen, particularly when it's something like, a lot of the stuff like during 2020 and 2021 was like very solid mutual aid stuff, that if it doesn't happen, bad things will be consequences. So like, you know, if it's like someone's a bit late for a book deadline or something, who cares, right? But sometimes the consequences are more real. So I can kind of go like, okay, that's too much work. That will take too long to actually like properly decentralize in a way that's sustainable. So I'm just going to actually just do the thing and have a KISS centered project. And I have plenty of those, and that's easier. It is easier. And then I think when I'm trying to do something decentral, like particularly when it starts decentralized and horizontal and collective, obviously I think that like foundation is very different than trying to include people in something or change the essence of the group. And yeah, sometimes I think the decentralizing or sharing skills, building capacities is the project, and I probably won't get much else done. And if I want to get things done, I'll probably just like do it or like work with a few individuals that I know are like very efficient, and we'll do the thing and we'll just like do the thing very quickly before breakfast. And then the rest of the day, I'll spend lots of time like very patiently skill sharing. And like, yeah, I don't want it to sound as patronizing as that, but I do feel like they're different, and the speed and the efficiency are different. And sometimes it's not true. Sometimes that's a story that I'm telling myself. Like if I work with people, it will be slow and annoying. And if I work by myself, I'll get it done. And I think that's also just a story that I tell myself. Sometimes working with people is wonderful because we have a diversity of responses, as we were talking about this morning. We have diversity of like approaches and ideas. And sometimes that's actually what we needed. And I wouldn't have done as well if I was just by myself. So yeah. Mixed feelings about it, I guess.
Well, and I think that, yeah, that thing of like, is this function something that you can do or something that other people can do? So I know, for example, with the Mobile Herbal Clinic Calais, it has to be a team. Like, there's no way on earth I could work in France on my own as a medic and do that safely, right? Like, you need a team, you need someone translating and giving information sheets about the medicine and about where to go to hospital. You need someone else doing first aid. You need someone else, you know, with more clinical experience, like holding that space, like as the clinical supervisor. So I think for me, it's kind of like my sort of deciding kind of design factors are like, yeah, like, can I do that thing on my own without harming myself and other people? So, for example, like the podcast is kind of like quite a nice like solo project where it doesn't, like Kez said, it's not like this kind of direct mutual aid. So it's kind of like much easier to do it as your own kind of creative outlet. Whereas I think, yeah, like projects where the stakes are quite high, like, for example, with prisoner support, like I had quite a bad nervous breakdown several years ago after just like six bereavements in a row and like all sorts of stuff, and me dropping back from prisoner support groups, like it did affect the support that those prisoners got, even though I had been desperately trying to build that up to like strong collectives, you know, training people, mentoring people. But I think you're right of like when there's that like direct harm, like, you know, like I remember you were doing a project fundraising for people to support like trans women to get home safe, and it's like, you know, if that woman doesn't have that money for that taxi, like they're really vulnerable. So it's like, I do think when things like are quite high stakes, like that does demand like stronger collectives where you're like, yeah, I couldn't possibly support every trans woman in the world, do you know what I mean, on my own, and I didn't have to, and where would be the sort of like political power building in that. Whereas I think, like we've talked about this, there's often like a kind of not shame, but there's like a taboo around like solo working. Like I've had critique about running the apothecary like as my own project kind of thing, and that it should be collective. And it kind of was like interesting how triggering what that was to me, probably because there's like a bit of it that I think that is true, that should be collective. But on the other hand, it was like, you know, like say you have like unions of workers, like lots of them are also like individual, right? Like individual people, like small solo self-employed businesses are actually like the biggest form of business. Like, so it's like, you know, when back in the day, if it was like carpenters or tradesmen or something, like organizing a union, like they would all be individuals but working together. And I think you can be a herbalist working on your own, like you would have someone in the village, like, you know, in the 1800s or whatever, where I live, serving that function, but they wouldn't necessarily do it with someone else. But as long as we're sort of collectively building power and I'm kind of connecting with other herbalists and trying to, you know, do stuff collaboratively with each other, I don't think there's anything problematic about doing something that's like a solo output, you know, like loads of people write books on their own, for example, or do illustration, or, you know, so it's kind of like, if that's your craft, I think that's okay. And I also think it's important to like acknowledge the impacts of relational trauma, that actually for some people, collective organizing, it's like doing it with like a massive rucksack of stones on you, you know, if your life experiences have been being socialized to not trust people and have people fuck you over and have people abuse you or whatever in prison. It's like actually part of kind of something that's liberatory to me is like, actually, what does, you know, how can you meet your own needs? And I think with this like caring stuff, we're so used to, as like working class femmes, putting everyone's needs above our own. Like you're born with that to of how you exist in the world. That's how you access love, is by just putting everyone's needs above your own and caring for everyone. So I think it's actually like quite a defiant act to me to be like, no, I'm going to work on a project where I have autonomy. I can be creative. I can go at my own pace. I can choose who I collaborate with and who I don't. And also I can kind of have a livelihood from that that sustains me, you know? So yeah, but maybe if this is interesting to people, this thread, maybe Kez, you could talk about that, of like that sort of solo-ness kind of thing. Which is also, sorry, yeah, not the right word, because neither of us do anything alone. Like, it's constant collaboration with translators and prisoner books, right, and people in Calais, and sending medicine to this refugee crew who like texted me asking for them. So it's like nothing, it's like an illusion, the aloneness, but at the same time, we have to be transparent about, hey, this is like my kind of creation or my baby, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking as well. It's like they're both, yeah, myths in a way. Collectives in like our culture usually aren't so collective as people like to think that they are. And individual projects are usually a lot more interdependent and collective than people might understand them to be. So yeah, I think that both of those are like simplifications of what's really going on. I think there's also an interesting dynamic that some models are kind of prioritized, and like the idea that people are telling you what, how you should be organizing, like immediately all my like little cat heckles, whatever, I'm like, don't tell Nicole how to do what Nicole does, because other people, like nobody tells them how to do things, like particularly writers, for example, as you say, like, or certain like more prestige activities, that's totally fine. And like being like the person out in the wilderness doing it by yourself is given a lot of prestige. But when you're a community organizer, you have to be doing it in a certain way that somebody has decided that this is what a collective organizing looks like. Again, it's a simplification, it's a myth. And so who's deciding which is the best model, I think, is also an interesting thing to analyze. And I had another thought. Yeah, maybe that's that for now. And I think also, yeah, so who's deciding which is the best, who's prioritizing and who's saying like this model is better than this model? And I wonder if it is always based on like some kind of pure and abstract politics of like collective is better than individual and something. Maybe. And I wonder if sometimes those people who are like, no, you must do everything collective, have the most to gain from being in a collective. Because in my experience, sometimes the people who are like, go, 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 collective is better and individualism is bougie. And like, if you're living by yourself, you're bourgeois and you must live in a collective housing project and do everything collectively. They learn from us. They get their needs met before our, like, sometimes I think there might be some like invisible hierarchies or some like, mixed motivations there. They're like, you should be in a collective with me so that I can like out of you. But maybe not. Maybe I'm being very cynical. But I don't know that it's always like perfect and pure, like that one thing is better than the other. I think like, yeah, and like whatever works, right? And meeting our needs, even when we're working so much for other people, but also like making sure we prioritize our own needs, super, super, super important. And if we can't do that in a group of 30 people having like endless meetings and 4-hour check-ins, then that's not for us. Never again. Do you have any other threads you'd like to put
up? I just wanted to say on that, like the, like challenging the binary thinking, right? Of like, yeah, you know, one thing doesn't have to be better than the other thing. And, you know, are they like even contradictory anyway, right? And I think what's interesting about me and Kez, of like what we talk about a lot, is we've both sort of grown up in these movements since a really young age. So like, while a lot of people are trying to unlearn the sort of bullshit their parents have taught them, or like schooling or whatever, I think we're somehow trying to unlearn movement dynamics with and trying to understand like what's oppressive about certain organizing patterns, and like, you know, coming from a movement where you do get a lot of social capital going to prison, you know, or like the person who sacrifices the most is like, you know, you're kind of rewarded with that. And I was similar age to Kez. I was literally 10 years old when I started a little group at school, and, you know, was like going to like national demos and all sorts of stuff from like 13, like in the Anarchist Federation from when I was like 11. So it's like, of course, I'm going to think that my self-worth is based on my like output of like what I'm doing for these movements and what I'm contributing to them. And somehow I think the reason like people can get triggered by you doing like a solo project is actually because they've got like an unmet need of like, you know, feeling like invisibilized in a movement or something. Like, I don't know, it's interesting stuff, but
Yeah,
you know, what time we open up to questions, or where it's 22, but yeah, I'm happy to keep going. Or yeah,
let's put up one more thread and then let's go for questions. But you get to pull the thread this time, which what have you been dying to ask me in a public room?
Oh, that could be a little bit X-rated. No, I'm joking.
Maybe that was the wrong framing for this conversation.
I'm put on the spot. I think, like, how do non-humans, like, influence your work? Because for me, like, it's the herbalism that really drives everything I do, and I have a lot of relationships with plants, and the medicine is what sustains me to keep doing the organizing. You know, people are like, oh, how do you keep going without burning out? And I'm like, well, plant medicines, you know, like everything is. But I'm just interested for you, like, how do your sort of like animistic kind of relationships with non-humans, like, how do they influence like what you're doing and how you're creating?
Yeah, thanks. I think it happens in two ways at the same time. It is sustaining my work, and I think it is my work. So without being too meta and abstract, it's like, I think there's a lot of things where I think of like collective care, nature connection, all of these imperfect terms, but you know what I mean? Where there's one view of it that is like, yes, we need to do these things. We need to sleep. We need to dream. We need to care. And we need to connect with the non-humans so that we can sustain this other thing. And I think the other perspective, and again, it's not a binary, is like, no, that is the thing. Like, if we're coming to the here and now, if we're like reconnecting and like breaking those binaries that we've been culturally encultured with, if we are making connections, then that is actually like, that's the thing we're missing sometimes. And the more we're doing that, hopefully on a collective level and not just like me sitting in my garden, but the more that we're doing that, I think that sometimes is the work, in fact, of like, that's the opposite of capitalism. That's the opposite of extractive colonialism. It's the opposite of that. And I think it's not just to sustain the other thing. Sometimes it is. That's fine. Like, taking a deep breath and listening to the nightingales. I have a lot of nightingales here. So that we can fight another day, okay? But also maybe that is partly the fight for me. It's like, that's sometimes I think what we're missing. And when I can encourage people to be in the park in Berlin and slow down and listen to the nightingales, I think it's not only to sustain the other thing, but that is the thing that we're missing sometimes. And we're like, oh, fuck, wow, I'm in a living world. Now I want to, like, fucking defend it. Like, I think that connection is sometimes what we're missing. So that's in a very abstract sense. But I spend all the time I can listening to the birds, particularly. They've always been my friends. I was running this, like, little bird group when I was very, very small. And I was running workshops and writing newsletters, and I'm still a nerd for birds, really. Like, I don't know how good those workshops were, but probably very cute. And yeah, they still call me just because they're so easy, I think. Like, I think that, like, yeah, I'm really experiencing it with like these like nature walks and stuff, that it's like people know a few birds and they're always around, luckily, hopefully. So that's quite an easy kind of entry point or something. And I've noticed like lots of people are like, teach me the birds. I'm like, okay, there's quite a few. But, you know, if you get to know a blackbird, you're probably going to bump into a blackbird at some point and you can be like, spread that love with somebody else. It's such a weird thing, but somehow it feels really powerful to me. And yeah, I know my plant friends are the same. They're like, once you know a dandelion, you can be like, look at this dandelion. Let me tell you some stories about the dandelion. I think that idea of stories and memes, meme in the original sense of like a packet of information that you're giving to someone else. You can be like, here's my dandelion story. Now you have my dandelion story. Like, please spread that so that other people are like going through the day and they're like, oh, fuck, a dandelion. Ooh, that reminds me of a story I heard. Like, I think that that really brings us into the moment. It brings us into connection. There's something very powerful about something so simple. The end.
I love that so much. I just hosted like a 3-day practical medicine making intensive. And yeah, like it reminds me of that, of like what you were saying at the beginning around, like at the beginning of this bit around it is the work. Like, and someone literally burst into tears in a sort of closing go round, which isn't unusual, but they were like, I've been so despairing about the world and about like, is it possible to live differently, you know, when everything feels so dark and awful and like traumatic. And then she was like, yeah, it is. Like, we've done it this weekend, you know, people have been kind to each other and we've been in good relationship with the land and we've eaten food that's grown on site and we've harvested plant medicines with our own hands that can then nourish us into the future. And I think, yeah, like maybe there's a tendency to take that for granted, I think, because I'm so like functional of, oh, I need to get these care packages in the post and, oh, we've run out of Cosset for Calais, like blah, 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 blah. But then when I'm with someone and that's literally the first time in their life where they've connected with a plant, it's really nice to witness that like magical connection, you know, because like, especially having like a baby now, it's like, yeah, like most kids, like, you know, or most adults, like they can recognize like thousands of corporate logos, but can hardly name like more than 10 plants. And that was definitely my childhood. Like, I didn't come from any sort of wholesome plant loving family or anything. So it's like, you know, like, I think that power of introducing someone to a plant or an animal or a bird, like that is so, yeah, just kind of like liberatory, you know, in its own way. Yeah.
It really is. I love you, Nicole. Thanks for putting that thread. I loved it. Any questions from all the other people? It's probably quite intimidating to ask us a question, to be fair. But please ask your questions. Or reflections or things that you're like, that reminds me of my life. Or even like concrete things like, how do you do XYZ? Or,
Yes. I want to now know the dandelion story. What's the name? Löwenzahn.
Löwenzahn, dandelion.
Yeah.
Nicole can tell you the herbal story. I can tell you the queer story.
Give us the queer one first.
Oh my gosh, I don't know why I brought up dandelions. I've forgotten the story. Okay, what I remember is what we think of as being one species, Taraxacum something something, is actually a whole multitude of species. So it's already like fucking with some categories. It's one of these ones that actually like there's a whole bunch of possibly subspecies and populations that don't really interbreed. So the idea of like a species of dandelion is already just a mess. In fact, it seems like multiple species. So it's kind of queering, troubling, all of those very simple classifications, which are not real things. We just made them up. And they switch between sexual reproduction and asexual reproduction in different places. So I think the dandelions in Europe mostly reproduce sexually, and then where they've colonized, so I think in the Americas, they switch to an asexual reproduction because it's much, much faster and they can kind of spread over land much quicker than using sexual. And then once they're kind of established, I think they switch back to sexual reproduction. So different populations have different forms of sex. Kind of queer. Nicole.
Oh, I was enjoying that. I was like,
The end.
I love it when you're a nerd. It's like the best version. Not the best version, but it's like, it's the version I don't see that much that when it comes out, I'm like, yeah, just go for it.
It's all right. I've written you a whole book, Nicole. You
can I'm really excited to read
100,000 words of my nerdiness. Don't worry, it's coming.
Don't let me edit it, though. It's, you know, that's your skill. Yeah, I mean, how I can talk a little bit about how I work with Dandelion, like as a herbalist. So I think Dandelion is this like amazing like gateway herb because most people can recognize Dandelion and it grows like literally everywhere. Especially when I was in prison, it was like, you know, popping up through the cracks in the concrete. And I talk about it in the prisoner's herbal of I literally like slept with a Dandelion root like under my pillow for a lot of my sentence and would like eat the fresh leaves and like dry the leaves and the roots on the prison radiator and make people like tea and stuff with it. And yeah, when you're eating such a kind of awful, like industrially produced processed food, like, you know, especially with a lot of like really intense types of like bad fats, it just was like very helpful in supporting the kind of like liver health. So it's got a real affinity with the liver and sort of communicating to the body to help produce like enzymes and bile and different things to help us digest. So yeah, it has this like strong digestive affinity as well as like many, many, many other actions. But yeah, I think it's like a fantastic plant for people that are like new to herbalism because it's just like so generous with its like flavor and its medicine. And yeah, there's so many different like folk names for dandelion and different, yeah, like I said, different species like all over the shop. So yeah,
I love it when you're a nerd as well. I put the dandelion plant profile from your website in the text comments thing. More questions.
Yeah. So I hope you can hear me. So I just really like this notion or what you said, Cass, about maybe it's not, I don't know if I understood you right, but for me it was less about what the plants and the animals tell you, but rather the stories you receive and you share with others and therefore create a sort of connection to this by sharing it with other people. And this brings me kind of to a question to Nicole, whether your work during the time spent in prison has maybe influenced other people or even the system itself, you know, by practicing this this relationship and also by sharing it and by living it in this context.
Just to clarify, like the sort of impact of the book and the work on the prison system, or?
No, like the example you just made by, for instance, making tea. I mean, it's kind of a subversive act of rebellion kind of against the food they served you in this context, for instance. And I just wondered whether that influenced also the system itself and maybe how they do it in the future or how other people spending time there kind of deal with district, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like, well, I think it's worth saying that like prisoners throughout history have made medicine from plants. And I often get like lots of cute people emailing me saying like, have you heard about this guy? Like he pressed all these flowers in this book while he was in prison and stuff like this. And like different people's prison diaries, they write about birds that they see regularly and stuff like from their windows and things or their cells. But yeah, I think like I've had a lot of contact with people in prison who have like developed that relationship with a plant. And I guess just like content warning here about suicidality, like I've had people write to me who, you know, like have literally been on like just the sort of edge of wanting to die in prison. Obviously, like suicides in prison are really huge, like high rate, especially in the UK. And yeah, like people have said like, oh, I was about to do this and then I saw this plant, you know, that I recognized from your book. And they had this like powerful connection with this herb of like, this herb is like reminding you like, we're alive, like we're here, like the prisoner trying to kill us with Roundup and pesticides, but yet we keep coming back and we keep surviving. And that like, yeah, there is an alternative to the gray walls and everything else. And I think, yeah, I've had like several people write to me who've had that experience of like such a strong relationship with a plant. And one of the people I interviewed for my podcast was a woman called Jackie Sumel from this project called Solitary Gardens. And she works with, she's based in the like the so-called US, and she works with people in solitary confinement, and they communicate with her and her sort of community groups outside to build gardens for the prisoners, like in the like the size and the shape of the cell. So if someone is in like a 2x3 cell, they'll make a garden the same size and they'll plant all the plants that that prisoner wants them to plant and then send them photos and things. And yeah, like she works with a lot of like Black Panther prisoners who've been in prison for like 40 plus years. And yeah, for them, they've definitely, you know, that's also like really like sustained their struggle. And also this sort of like kind of more like decolonizing relationship of like, you know, like connecting to plants like of their ancestors, or, you know, plants that were like, you know, taken away from people when they were like enslaved, or like plants that have come from West Africa or other locations. So it's like, yeah, there's just like so many layers to it. And I love her work so much because it does like, yeah, just remind me, like when I do presentations about the prisoner's herbal, I always tell people like the solution is not herbalism in prison. Like the solution is like no more fucking prisons. Like, you know, like I'm not advocating like for prison gardens and things. Like I'm just advocating to support people in prison to survive those sentences. And if like the difference between wanting to die and wanting to live is like, you know, having some like chamomile tea or something, then that's like amazing, right? Yeah. Check.
I have nothing to add.
Can I ask another thing? I'm just wondering, well, you can both or even others respond, but now Nicole, as herbalist, maybe how do you, I don't know how to say it, how do you make kind of interactions with plants, or how do you harvest them, or with what thoughts or what awareness? Because I feel like for you, plants are also like beings and not just something green that comes from the ground and you can just take it and do whatever you want. So I'm just wondering what is kind of your approach or your thoughts behind using the plants to make medicine, using the plants to, yeah, whatever you do.
Should I go Kes on that first? Or? Yeah, we talked about this on the medicine making course actually, of like, trying to have like a kind of like consent focus of like, I always ask a plant, like, is it okay if I like harvest you today? And like, I got people to respond with like their experiences of when they felt kind of rejected by a plant. Like maybe that's like a really strong sensation of just like, no. And maybe it literally is sometimes like getting smacked in the face with like a bunch of thorns or a bramble or something. But yeah, I think like, it's kind of like, you know, like I talk about it in the prisoner's herbal, this like plant ally practice where it's like really connecting with a plant like in depth by just sitting with them and hanging out with them. And like, it's amazing how I can have 15 people on a course and they can all go and do an activity with a different plant, yet their response to that plant that I've not said one word about is, and they've encountered it for the first time, their comments are like the same as the people on the groups the last 3 years in a row. Oh, when I sat next to this plant, I felt like this, this, and this. And like, you know, like lots of, you know, Indigenous writers and stuff like Braiding Sweetgrass, like Robin Wall Kimmerer, she writes about, yeah, like how there is just this kind of like sort of intrinsic relational knowing of, you know, what, how plants are worked with like throughout history on different continents. Like even if people hadn't crossed each other, they've all been said that the plant has told them themselves, if that makes sense. I mean, I also have a tendency to have like a bit of a like utilitarian like biomedical approach, like because of my training, and like that's something I'm always kind of trying to like contend with and like unlearn a bit, because I'm quite sort of naturally sciencey. So yeah, maybe Kez, you can talk about that, of that bridge of like navigating different ways of knowing, like, and being pregnant. It was interesting because I was so unwell through my pregnancy that for the first time in 15 years, I wasn't able to harvest any medicine. And it made me realize, like, fuck me, like, I'm really interacting with my garden in this, like, hyper extractive way of, like, oh, this plant needs to be harvested. Oh, I need to pick the hawthorns before they go. Or, you know, oh, the rose is going to finish. I need to get as much as possible before the roses finish. Whereas like the first time, ironically, when I was pregnant and also sort of learning to receive more and be supported by other people and have everything come this way so that I could go this way, it was like teaching me like, oh yeah, like they're not fucking there for you to harvest, you know, and they're thriving and they're fine. And, you know, obviously some plants like really like all plants, but lots of plants flourish from a human relationship of harvesting and cultivating them. But yeah, it was just like an interesting learning for me of like, how much plants are just like really autonomous. And yeah, sorry, I'm like, ugh. But maybe Kez, you have things to say on that?
I thought it was super clear. I think that as you framed it, like different ways of knowing, that makes sense. I feel like there's multiple things happening for me at the same time. So with herbs, with birds, with whoever I'm in relationship with, there is that storytelling part, and there is also the direct relationship. And sometimes they are the same and sometimes they're a bit different. Sometimes they inform each other. But yeah, there's usually both. And I think that that's kind of, it's important for me to kind of reflect on it, because, you know, the relationships definitely came before the stories in a way. Although, like, I don't know, if I think of some of the like most familiar bird species for me, or orange tip butterflies as an example I always come back to, because there were lots where I used to live when I was 10. There was a story that I was given, a cultural narrative of like, everything is dead, who cares, exploited, extracted, humans are the only thing that's important. Then I learned some stories about, then I like met some orange tip butterflies and I spent lots of time with them and I built a relationship. Then I probably learned some stories about orange tip butterflies that were different to that like dominant narrative. And so I think there's often these multiple layers, and it's just more like being aware of all those things happening. And I also spent a lot of time with orange tip butterflies, or starlings, for example. So we already, like this morning, we already talked about starlings a bit. And I've definitely known people who will be like, starlings are a great metaphor for community organizing and emergent properties and something, something. And I'm like, there is that story and we can learn from that. And that's cute. But also, have you spent hundreds of hours with starlings? Because they're fucking amazing. So like, just spend some time with the starlings as well and build that direct relationship. Otherwise, I think it can become extractive for medicine, extractive for stories. I think we're primed and like cultured to extract. And so it can be that unlearning that we were talking about earlier, of just kind of like, oh, what is that tendency? Where is that coming from? What am I trying to get here? Am I trying to, what am I trying to get out of this? And I think particularly with my work at the moment, I think this, I'm navigating this kind of like objectifying other species, systems, whatever the fuck they are, to learn something so that we can community organize. And that just doesn't feel like the right motivation. It's not the worst one, but that has to be balanced out with like direct relationship. And I think that, you know, I learn a lot from stories. For sure. And as I say, it can, like, a story can be like a little package that you pass on and it kind of spreads and it gives people a moment. But I think also at the same time, teaching people to just be like, here's a dandelion and just like have a moment with a dandelion, like taste them, touch them, love them, see where they live. That's just as powerful. And that's also something that can be spread. Like, I think we're really built for stories, but if we can relearn that like direct sensory connection as well, that's probably even more powerful. So I think, like, let's teach people dandelion stories, but also let's teach people to like sit with a dandelion and be like, hi. Oh my God, I've seen so many of you and I've never spent time with it. Like, I think that direct connection is also a really powerful thing that we can, encourage.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Okay, Basil already has to head out. Thank you for sort of sharing your work insights. And bye, Basil. I think that we're coming to the end of our hour anyway. Maybe one more question before Nicole has to rush off. Laura, you made this happen. You should get the final question.
I was thinking about your reference of Robin Wall Kimmerer and about the question of what does it mean to understand the relationships in reciprocity, and if you have any practice to share how you also are giving back, or what kind of an understanding of giving back and also maybe receiving, because you were mentioning also how you or in which ways you need to unlearn maybe the caregiver roles. If you could comment on this as a last question.
No problem. Like, for me, I think, like, I talk about it a bit in the PTSD course of like reciprocity with plants, of like, if they're really taking care of us, like humans, and obviously plants take care of all their non-humans too, and each other, you know, sending each other chemical messengers all around their root systems and with mushrooms and all sorts of stuff. Like, I think the least we can do is kind of like show up for the habitats, you know, like, in maybe that's like struggles, like kind of eco-defense struggles of like defending land that is like threatened by capitalism, by new developments, by mining, like all of these things, you know, or whatever people are doing, like even trying to, you know, resist kind of climate change is kind of a way of, you know, working for our ecosystems. So yeah, like, I think for me, that's why I love supporting people like involved in those sorts of struggles, because like, yeah, that's kind of one way to give back to plants. And then I also just think kind of like, yeah, like sort of direct like habitat creation, and like, it fills me with joy to think that lots of people have read my book and then started a herb garden, or started, you know, even just like in prison, just like letting the dandelions survive, right? Not like weeding everything, but just kind of, you know, so sometimes I feel like, am I just some weird vehicle for dandelions to just, you know, propagate all over the place? Because like, people will hopefully like fall in love with them after reading the book and having that direct relationship. So yeah, I think that kind of solidarity is important, and just sort of like, it's really fucking hard in capitalism to be like any sort of like ethical or whatever. And like, we make compromises all the time, you know, like we buy little plastic bottles for Calais because we can't dispense medicine in glass bottles with broken glass like in the refugee camps. So it's like, you're always making these compromises, but as far as I possibly can, like, if I'm not harvesting or growing a plant medicine myself, I will always try to work with like an organic supplier or someone growing that plant like locally with integrity as much as I can, and, you know, like avoiding using endangered species and things like this. And then, yeah, my brain's gone of the second part. Oh yeah, receiving. So I actually wrote a thing on the old Instagram about like herbalism as an act of rebellion against self-neglect, where like, if you sort of, yeah, grow up in like sort of context that me and Kez grew up, where, you know, your needs are very repressed to care for other people, then I felt like the way I learned to care for myself was through herbalism, through herbs teaching me, like, oh, I've got a little bit of a cold coming on. Oh, I'm going to work with, you know, ginger or make a thyme tea or something. And it's like, it was this like passion for herbalism that taught me about my body and taught me to listen to my body and my body's needs. And I don't think it was the other way around. Like, a lot of people get into herbalism because of experiences with chronic illness and, you know, getting nowhere with, you know, lots of like, you know, allopathic medicine. So like, whereas I feel like it was herbs for me that taught me to slow down, that taught me, okay, you don't have to do like 5 billion emails today. You can go out and literally walk 3 miles of hedgerow harvesting hawthorn flowers or elderflower. And that has then taken care of my nervous system. So I think herbs and plant medicines have just been integral to kind of, yeah, learning how to receive like that direct medicine, but also that like act of herbalism. I will put that bit of writing on a blog sometime. Don't know when, but it will happen.
Thank you so much for sharing.
I'm so sorry, but I better go back to the baby.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for having me. The invitation, and anyone's welcome to email me anytime and I'll reply when I can, because I don't get on the computer very often right now. But yeah, thank you so much, Kez. I love you. You've been amazing. I'm so jealous of you. Have no idea how lucky you are to have a whole day of Kez teaching you.
yeah, definitely.
Teaching is a bit tiring, but like,
I live with her. It's not that great, I have to say.
Yeah.
It'd be a bit much.
Yeah, it's been amazing.
Thanks so much, Nicole.
Take care. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Bye-bye. Yeah, so...
Do you feel like answering as well, or should we leave
Yeah, I can briefly... It reminded me that I often think of bird medicine, which is not a really commonly... articulated thing, but I feel like it's not so medicinal, like listening to the birds and watching the birds, it's not medicinal in the same way that Lovensan can help your liver or something. But I feel like there is a, when Nicole was saying, like, some of the prisoners that she'd received letters from were like, oh, I found the Lovensan and it really helped me, and I was also watching the birds and that helped me. I think there is a bird medicine. It's not just birds, I'm just obsessed with them, but I think it's something I haven't really articulated, but I think it's something I'm learning to, of just that, how they bring me so much into the present moment, into my senses, into my perceptions, that in itself is like an active, actively therapeutic act or something, but also, again, not only in terms of what it does for me, but in terms of like learning to listen and find out what's going on. And in terms of reciprocity, like, they've been coming here to the bird feeder this entire time. So that's a thing I do. I feed them all the time. I have so many Spatzen. Like, I don't think it's probably great, like the best ecological balance, but their populations are struggling. So I don't mind them being happy little Spatzen. And yeah, indeed, ecological defense, that's part of it. That's part of reciprocity. When I'm supporting people defending our ecosystems, that's part of what I can give back. And just, I think also giving them my presence, like, not that I'm like amazing and what a gift, but I think like the fact of me listening to them very closely and being in relationship with them means that I'm looking out for them. I'm taking care of their habitats. I'm not disturbing them in the same way that if I just didn't care and I ignored them and I was just like crashing through the forest. I think that all those things that are very hard to measure, maybe, are also part of that relationship. That's my answer.
Thank you so much. I'm curious when we will be able to read your book.
Some students did this morning. They already
read
the first to have read anything from this book. Some of it I'm putting up on in the text box. There's Pink Green, which is my Substack. So I'm already like posting small self-contained modules or stories or whatever. And those are also audio mostly. So that's a way that I'm pre-releasing it, because a book is a big project. Yeah. I don't have a publisher yet, but I do have the first draft and it's in editing for my friends. So yeah, hard to know exactly how long it takes, but it's written and it's already pretty cute. And it's also like, I have to show you Nicole's book. Like, these other ones are like normal little book sizes, but this is like a monster. So it's probably going to be about as big as that, because clearly I have a lot of words and a lot of ideas and I can't stop talking. So big book coming soon. Not sure.
We send some good energies into this direction.
Thank you.
Very soon published.
I appreciate that.
I heard one voice in the back, from somewhere, but I was not sure if this is a question or a comment.
Yeah, I just want to ask if you're singing with the birds.
Of course, all the time.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I used to do it a lot when I was little. I really liked the kind of vocality of like mimicking. Or when I was little, I was a bit naughty and I would like make a cuckoo sound so that the cuckoo would get pissed off and come very close and like be territorial just because I wanted to see him. So not always with good intentions, but I think particularly I do it a lot when I'm teaching my friends the birds, because I'm like, that's part of the identification package, is like they sound like this, and then teaching people to kind of identify, because it's so interesting in the way that people have what they call green blindness. It's an ableist term, but this sense of there's just green and that's all I see and I just can't separate it. I think people often have like audio, I don't have a good term for it, but the same with birds. They'll just be like, there's just birds. I can tell that they are birds and not flowers, but I don't know anything else. And so teaching people to kind of pull them apart a little bit, it takes such concentration. It takes such like being in your body to do it. And then you start to build a relationship and you build your own like experiences and stories. You're like, oh my God, it's an Amsel. That reminds me of this other time with an Amsel. And also look at this beautiful Amsel right here and listen to the story. I think it is part of building that relationship, is identification sometimes as well.
Thank you.
Laura, what is happening for the rest of the day? I have material for the next month. For the rest of the month, then we can just stay here and we can like keep going. But I think some of you have to go at 3:30, and I'm just wondering how far we're going to get with the afternoon material.
How about if we would do a little break of 10 minutes and then meet again for the people who can, and then do like a little reflection or check out together what, how it resonated or how it should continue.
That sounds great.
Yeah?
Yeah. Either way, definitely a break is a good idea. And then whoever can come, can come. If you don't come back, like, thanks for being here. I had a really nice time with you all. Yeah, I'll say more later, but if you're leaving now and you've only been here just for this session or the morning, I just really appreciated this. I had a really nice time. I wish we were going until 6, which is not time that I invented. It was not the real time. I just made it up. I was like, yeah, let's do a 7-hour Zoom day. You probably didn't want that. I just had a really, really nice time. And I love these subjects. Like, as I said, particularly for the morning, this is the first time I've done this. This is material that I just kind of created a few months ago. It's super fresh, it's super new, and super vulnerable as well, to be like, does this make any sense? Is this useful? I mean, I hope so.
It's you can so tell generous me, that you share it with us.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know how it landed, how you've been experiencing it. Let's take a break, come back in 10 minutes.
Yes.
Enjoy your breaks.
Thank you. See you in a bit, and bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Frontline Herbalism podcast. You can find the transcript, the links, all the resources from the show at solidarityapothecary.org/podcast.